I think it'll be also a very interesting panel following on the ones we've had on discussing what are the possibilities and what are the options within financing. In particular, if there were no government programs, what would the private market invest in that? And we'll assemble that in just a moment. So Ted Roosevelt has graciously offered to moderate this panel. Ted is currently the managing director of investment banking at Barclays Capital, where he serves as chairman of the firm's clean tech initiative, although I understand that they're probably going to be doing a little rebranding of that. Ted actually has quite significant experience in banking and finance. He's been working for about 39 years, I believe, in the industry, and I think understands it very well from all perspectives, especially the need to have return on investments, as well as the need to look around for, you know, the right investment at the right time. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ted.
Thanks for that introduction. And let me quickly introduce the panel. All of you, I believe, have probably read their bios, which are impressive. But on my immediate right is Ethan, who works for Bloomberg New Energy Finance. And some of you may not know exactly what Bloomberg New Energy Finance is, but like Bloomberg, which is gives you all the data that you want about what's happening on in the market, they do that around new energy finance. So if you want to find out, like everything that Bloomberg does, nothing is for free. And if you buy one service, you don't get another one for free. It's a great business model, I can tell you that. But they will give you an incredible array of data of what's happening in this sector, what are happening to solar prices, how fast they're coming down, what's happening to wind prices, et cetera. And it's a tremendous resource. To his right is Hank Habeck, who is one of two co-managing partners at Sail Venture Capital. And they are, in my opinion, one of the smarter venture capital firms in this area. They've been in it for a good long time. Hank, personally, I think you made an investment back with Bill Ruckelshaus a long darn time ago, in the 80s, if I remember correctly. So, you know, there are not many people anywhere that can say they've been in this business for a time when you were virtually a young teenager.
Thank you.
And then Elizabeth works for the Global Environment Fund, and her role there, and let me start off with that fund. They've been around since 1990. It's about a $1 billion fund, but they are truly global in that they've invested all over the world, in South America and Africa and Asia, some in the United States. And her job is to bring in the limited partners who are going to invest in their projects, but make sure that they understand what the risks are, what the time frame is going to be, and make sure that, you know, after they made investment, they don't say, oh, gee, I didn't realize it was going to be this risky, or have some other issue that might arise. So I'm going to start off and ask Ethan to give us a summary of sort of what's happened in this sector. And I'll preface it by saying that probably 7 or 8 years ago, before the 2008 crisis, we were all very enthusiastic. We thought this was going to be a terrific area, that the economic opportunities were going to be outstanding. And today, if you look at sort of the IPO market for clean tech generally, companies haven't performed well. They're selling at less their offering price. You go down and talk to your syndicate manager, and he or she will say, you know, Ted, bring me something else. I really don't want to sell this. The investors aren't interested in it. And that's sort of the environment we're in now. So with that as sort of a background, perhaps you can talk about what you're seeing, what's happening in this area, and why.
Sure. Maybe let me stand up. So hello, everybody. I'm Ethan Zindler, as was mentioned. Who we are, again, Bloomberg New Energy Finance. We're a division of Bloomberg now that provides market research on new energy technologies globally. This is where we have people around the world. About 130 of us in these offices. These are our small partial list of our clients, people who I guess have determined that they're willing to pay for the service. You know, as you can see, we have a number of government agencies here in Washington and around the world, as well as major oil producers and others. Very nice introduction. Appreciate that. I mean, our goal in life here is to be analysts, provide impartial information. We're not advocates for the industry. But we do believe that providing accurate and timely information will benefit the industry in the long run. All right, so I'm going to talk very briefly, hopefully, about what we've seen in terms of capital flows in the clean energy marketplace, and then just maybe one or two quick thoughts on policy, and then I'd much rather get into a discussion. So this is a look at clean energy capital flows globally. By clean energy, by the way, our definition on this chart is renewables plus biofuels. I know others define that differently. They might include nuclear, they might include natural gas, might include CCS. We do actually track that stuff too, but traditionally this has been our definition that we've used as clean energy. So you can see, you know, this spectacular run up from 2004 up through 2008 or so, a leveling off. As we hit the financial crisis, but not a big decline. And the main reason for the leveling and non-decline was there was a heck of a lot of money that governments made available in the form of economic stimulus for clean energy, about $190 billion globally by our account. And so that sustained the industry through 2008 and 2009. Things got back on track in 2010 and 2011. And then this happened. And as was alluded to, it's been a little bit tougher in the last 18 months or so in terms of fundraising for clean energy companies. Part of this 11% decline is explained by the fact that we've seen policy pullbacks in Western Europe, and it's become more challenging in the U.S. as well in terms of some of the subsidies that are available. But that's sort of the bad news side of the story. The good news side of the story is that a big part of this decline is also due to the fact that clean energy equipment prices have really, really come down, as has probably been mentioned earlier today. So you get a lot more bang for your buck. So we saw 11% less dollar flow, but actually the amount of gigawatts of new capacity installed in calendar year 2012 was actually up just a little bit. So each dollar is going further. Put that in a little bit of context, again, our definition of clean energy, which is just renewables and biofuels here. If you look at the amount of capital that was spent on power generation for clean energy versus fossil fuels, the lines are starting to get pretty close. And they're not, you know, they haven't crossed yet, but this is sort of my plug to say let's not call this alternative energy anymore, because it's attracting major chunks of capital. You know, going back to that first slide, about $1.5 trillion total is what we've counted since we started our business back in 2004. Unfortunately, this is a busy slide, and I ask you to stick with me. I sat in the back. I know it's tough to see back there, but I think it's worth mentioning just for a moment to think about where how private capital gets deployed into clean energy, which a number of you will know, but then also thinking about some of the existing government supports that come along to help each phase of that. So working really from left to right in the technology development phase, we go from research and development on the left all the way up to commercial maturity on the right. And as a technology advances along each one of these stages, and certainly Hank knows this better than I do, can talk in more detail, but at each stage, different kinds of capital from the private sector become available. You start out typically with lab funding or angel funding, then you get to venture round A funding, round B, round C, later rounds of venture financing, and eventually you get things like fundraising over the public markets and debt that can be provided for projects and for technologies at scale. In terms of the kinds of subsidies that come along, if you look on the bottom row, and I just kind of chucked this on there, but also to put it in context, you know, we've seen grants from the national labs, which typically can be supportive at the very earliest stage of technology. As you move further along, you can start to see where the loan guarantee program started to come into play, maybe 48C credits to some degree. And then as the technology becomes more diffuse and more advanced, typical production tax credits, investment tax credits help with diffusion. And finally, as you get to scale up, in theory, you could scale down some of these subsidies, or you could give them access to some of the other kinds of tax breaks that may be out there for conventional energy. Certainly the Master Limited Partnership Act is something that people are talking a good deal about here in Washington these days. I'm going to skip this just in the interest of time, except for to show the fact that venture capital, which is the money that goes into the earliest stage technologies in a typical year is about, you know, in the U.S. is about 10%, maybe less. We've tracked about $4 billion of the roughly $45 billion or $44 billion that went into the industry last year. As I can show you here, again, just to move a little further ahead, VC money has seen its ups and downs in terms of investment in the U.S., and you can see that the high water mark, at least that we tracked, was in 2008. This is a look at venture capital and private equity. Again, sorry for folks in the back, but I've chunked it here by different rounds, and we include private equity, which is for a very late round stuff. The bottom line is that we saw the high water mark a few years ago. I think there's certainly on the venture side been some hard lessons learned. I think Hank probably can talk to this. There's been some real folks who've been at this a long time, know the industry extremely well, like he does, and has been doing this for a while. And then we had a sort of surge of new venture investors that got very excited, sort of coincidentally right around the point in which the oil price hit $150 a barrel, invested a lot of money. And a lot of people, in my view, figured out that clean energy is not the same as investing in software. It's more capital intensive. It requires a lot more later round financing to go a lot further. And so we've certainly seen some retreat from the sector in terms of venture investment. And I think importantly, we've seen a shift towards things that look more like software. So energy management systems, smart grids, things like that that can be potentially scaled up and do not require the same level of capital to go further and further. So I'm going to finish without walking through every last step of this slide, but just to show you our view in terms of where public money comes in. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, we've tracked about $1.5 trillion of total investments since 2004. And if you were to ask me, how much of that money, would have been, was deployed or could have been deployed without any government support? I mean, honestly, I don't know the answer, but if I had to guess and then sort of round, I'd probably round it to about zero. Because the reality of it is that for the most part, clean energy technologies haven't been cost competitive with fossil generation. And so where a positive and supportive policy goes in place that bridges that gap between clean and dirty costs, that's where private capital pretty quickly thereafter follows, or in some cases, the smartest private capital is there, before the ink is even dry on the legislation. So that's really been the kind of global trend that we've seen up to now. But I think the really interesting story about what's going on now, right at this very moment, I mean now, like not now, like the last year, not now, I mean like now, because the price of these technologies is changing constantly, is that we're really starting to see cost competitiveness with these various technologies. I don't know if this will work, but maybe it will. So you look down here on the bottom, and we do this quarterly, and I know others do it, and there's other ways to do it, and levelized cost of energy is not a perfect way by any means to compare technologies. But for the sake of this, just FYI, our definition of LCOE is if you're an equity investor in a project and you want to earn a 10% rate of return, how much do you have to sell your juice at over a 20-year life to earn that 10% rate? Pretty simple. I know, probably too simple, but basic. And you can see down the bottom the cost of coal and nat gas. I mean, these are the real competitors. And then you can see the purple dots show some of these other technologies. And basically, a number of them have been moving this way. Of course, the goal is for the purple dots to come to the left and purple dots at the bottom, and so that they truly become cost competitive. It is starting to happen in a number of places. You may also notice that this shows a range of pricing. So for some of the windiest regimes in Oklahoma, for instance, we've seen wind projects built that are not being driven by subsidy, but because there's a great wind regime there. In Brazil, we've seen some very low price power contracts for wind. For producers who need dedicated power for mining and other things like that around the world, they're willing to sign contracts with renewable projects purely on economic grounds. So it is starting to happen. It hasn't happened completely. And the good news is I think that as we look longer term, less and less government and policy support is going to be needed for these technologies. But we're not there yet. So with that, I'm going to hand it back over and say thanks very much.
I might as well just stay here. We can start this as a as a conversation. Well, it's great to be here, and anytime Ted calls, we show up, whether it's Walter or me. He's a great partner and visionary in the field. And the one thing he didn't mention, that some of you know, that I served as chief operating officer of EPA when Bill Riley was administrator, who also has a great perspective on these issues. I used to call that like being the captain of the javelin team who elected to receive. And after hearing from our two congressmen, you can see that that really hasn't changed very much. There's a lot that hasn't changed. We tend to go around, you know, we see issues come around and around again, and that's a reality. But what I want to do is, there's so many things I could talk about. I wanted to sort of encapsulate my observations at a pretty general level about the investment climate, the perception of the private equity and financial community about government and the role that government's actions play. Because there is a real schizophrenia there, as you know. I mean, there are a lot of people in the investment community who say, I wouldn't invest in a company that is dependent on what the government does or doesn't do for its success. And yet, that means you wouldn't invest in energy at all. So, you know, we don't have a blank slate as far as, you know, I know that one of the mandates here for this panel is what does the government do? What if the government stopped doing something, would that be bad for investment and so forth? I mean, I think the government's impact on energy is pervasive. You've heard a lot about this. But so our view at SAIL is that you have to be literate. You have to be literate about what the government's doing. You have to be tuned into it. If you have an investment that makes sense on its own merits and there are government programs, buy-down programs, tax credits, things like that, of course, that's a benefit. That's something you'd want to take advantage of. But it's not the reason you would invest in a company, for all the reasons we know, because the government can be mercurial. So I guess my first point would be just an observation about one private equity participant's view of government, somebody who's sort of been in it, so I have a bit of a perspective on that. So obviously the government plays a number of different key roles. One is research and development and deployment. And the big issue between Republicans and Democrats has been, ever since the Synthetic Fuels Corporation, when I first got involved in government, is that it's the last couple of Ds in the RD, D&D kind of spectrum. And what's the role of government when you get to deployment? Well, as an investor, success is all about deployment. You know, we're excited about the technologies we invest in, but success for us is the technology is actually adopted and used. So we're interested that the government's interested in that part of the space, and if we can find ways for the government to be helpful, then that's great. So research, development, and deployment. Second, of course, is the finance and the tax side that we've heard a lot about. The third, of course, is regulatory. And the one area of sort of stability and something that as an investor I would count on would be regulatory mandates that are already in place. And we've heard at the earlier panel about the impact that Clean Air Act regulation has, you know, above and beyond almost any other kind of government action to promote clean energy, to promote the retirement of old coal plants, that sort of thing. But the government acts as a regulator in many ways. It can act in affirmative ways, like encouraging something through renewable portfolio or clean energy standards, through restrictions on activity like the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act and that sort of thing. And through regulating the way the market works, like FERC regulation. So the government is hydra-headed and has many impacts as a regulator and somebody who has a, you know, who reaches into the marketplace in various ways for various public policy reasons. Final area you heard a little bit about earlier is that the government is a big buyer of these kinds of products and services, and that's very important. So we look at all those things. I think the most important point, which we always hear, is that if the government's going to act, we need clarity and stability. We can't survive boom and bust impacts of well-meaning Congresses doing, you know, two-year initiatives that go away. So that's very important. Certainly the Clean Air Act is a quintessential example of a stable regime. I'm willing to bet my limited partner's money that major environmental regulations are not going to be repealed or significantly scaled back. I wouldn't say that about various financial incentives. The second point is that that despite, you know, the things that Ethan talked about, the absolute levels of investment are huge. And when it comes down 11%, that's significant. But if you look at the amount that's still being invested, you realize that clean energy has arrived and people are investing because it makes economic sense, because there are inexorable drivers for alternatives. You know, there are many of them. I always like to cite We'll hear from GEF a lot about this, but that the rise of the middle class in the world, you know, we've seen numbers that the middle class in the world will grow by 2 to 3 billion over the next 10 to 15 years. And when you go from the poverty to the middle class, your consumption of goods and services can go up anywhere from 3 to 5X, depending on what you're consuming. So there is going to be stress on resources. That's going to be a major economic driver. Also, just the fact of that demand growth in places that don't have infrastructure mean, as an investor, I have to look at emerging markets because that's really where the demand growth is. 75% of growth in demand over the next few years is going to be in what used to be, what were the non-OECD countries. So that's a very important factor. I think the other economic driver is that the utility model is broken. The electric utility model is broken. Everybody knows that that the circumstances have changed so dramatically that that just kind of getting by is no longer an option. I mean, at some point, we have to not only rethink, but begin to do the things it will take to make the electric grid and the regulations that govern it be in line with realities of technology and electricity demand, and in ways that utilities can make money. And that's a driver that's inexorable. And, energy efficiency, of course, it speaks for itself. Even Congressman Barton, who I respect, but's not a big fan of carbon taxes and things like that, says he's all in favor of greater output with less input. And as an investor, that's a simple formula we use. Is this something that gets you the same kind of result with less inputs, a more efficient process, and less undesirable outputs, meaning less waste and less pollution? It's a simple formula, but the economics work, and those drivers are there as well. The final economic point I would make is that the world's largest corporations, Chad Holliday is here, we have he's certainly seen this from many perspectives. The world's largest corporations have gone from being the pariahs to really being the focus of change, even more than government, because they have the resources, they have the global reach, they have the perspective on change because they operate in almost every global market. So what we look at in terms of both exits and adoption are the world's largest corporations. Third point, the biggest enemy of progress is turf. Compartmentalized views. I mean, it's something we all know inherently and we all complain about, like the weather, but you can do something. You can do more about it than we're doing. And, you know, I've served as an advisor to a number of the national labs like NREL and PNNL and Lawrence Berkeley. And I know one of the big priorities at DOE is grid integration. You know, we hear a lot about the smart grid. I don't think any two people would give you a consistent definition of what smart grid really means, but they know that it's an inevitable coming thing. And there are many companies that say we have the sine qua non of the smart grid. Our technology is the sine qua non of the smart grid. But you know, the utilities, the people who are kind of driven by what the government is putting out there, and investors are confused. You know, they don't really know. You know, does this fit what's the smart grid going to look like? Does this technology fit or doesn't it? So I think a big challenge for the government is first to really work across its stovepipes, to have the different offices within DOE, FERC, the states. It's a tall challenge, but we need to have some common perspectives. As soon as the investment community sees common perspectives from government on where electricity is going, that sort of thing, then they'll have a better sense of confidence that this idea will probably be adopted. This looks like it fills a gap, and it looks like it's the best run company and the best technology that fills that gap in, let's say, the electricity marketplace. And so that's something that's worth investing in. I cite one example, which is an area that we've invested in, is energy storage. Energy storage is kind of like plastics in the graduate. You know, now people are saying storage is really the next big thing. It's kind of the missing link in terms of being able to integrate, you know, thousands of generation sources into a grid that can really work and be stable, and that's true. But just over the last few years, I've seen first denial and then multiple perspectives on where storage fits, what the economics of storage are, what we need to do. You know, thank God for John Wellinghoff at FERC, who's really stepped forward and said we at FERC have to acknowledge that storage plays an important role. We don't have all the answers, but we need to put the wind to the back of this idea because it can really help with the intermittency issue and other things. But it's very important to get some common perspectives across the regulators on that. So adoption is key. I guess there's a lot more that I could say, but I guess I would say that a very important thing for the government to do, in addition to the kind of stability and certainty issues that we've all talked about, is for the government to give some guidance about what they see, like this grid integration. I think it's the grid tech team at DOE. It's very important for them to talk about how all the pieces of the grid of the future can come together. Investors can participate in that. I think there's also a lot of opportunity to improve. There's a lot of industry collaboration with the labs, but I think that there can be much improvement there, particularly if we look at some of the IP issues that keep collaboration when you get toward the commercialization stage from actually happening. And that there are some tools in place to do that. And if we have time, either now or later, we can talk about that. But I'll stop there. And
okay, thank you. Elizabeth, you probably bring more of a global perspective to this.
Sure, yeah. So Global Environment Fund might be helpful if I give just a little bit of description about what we do, and that really will shape the perspective of my remarks here today, I think, in terms of how I see the world. So Global Environment Fund was founded in 1990, as Ted said, with really the investment thesis that there are technologies and products and services out there in the world that were largely developed in this country and in Europe, that the rest of the world is going to demand as their incomes rise and as essentially as they demand the same things that we take for granted here, clean air, clean water at some basic level, and that investors, the private sector, really it can take advantage of this and can invest in these areas for a real financial return. Certainly, it's risky, and the risks in these markets are really around governance in the countries that we invest in. So we invest in Africa, we invest in Latin America, certain Latin American countries. We've invested in China and in Eastern Europe somewhat. We actually came to investing in the U.S. after we had invested for several years in the developing world. And so our perspective on the U.S. is a little bit different. But I guess just in terms of placing us next to what Hank and what Sale does is that we are probably a little bit more later stage, I would say, at least in terms of not quite having the technical know-how to invest in the sort of some of the technologies, I guess, that they invest in. So our objective very much is to invest in technologies that are proven with proven business models. We invest in companies that have revenues in the U.S. of $10 million or more and are EBITDA positive. So that distinguishes us a little bit from some of the firms that have invested in some of the more early stage world. I don't profess to really be an expert on some of the very early stage technologies that are out there and that I think the private sector has a very important role in investing in, but we've taken a little bit of a different approach. My background, actually, before I came to GEF, I've been at GEF for 6 years, but before that I was a management consultant working in large part with the DOE with their energy efficiency and renewable energy programs and then also with private corporations looking to move into alternative energy. So it was interesting for me when I came to GEF just to see how different the perspective is of an investor who is really looking at it just for profit, I guess. I guess the difference is just that it excludes a lot of areas that we just don't even look at for GEF. Our money comes from pension funds, university endowments, family offices, fund of funds. So that's sort of who we represent when we go to invest in these companies is really these financial institutions who are looking purely for a profitable return. Now, they're interested in our areas, certainly. They're not going to choose to invest in, say, a GEF fund versus Carlyle purely on the basis of, a return. They're not really going to put us in the same type of bucket. These investors usually have some belief that these sectors that we invest in are going to grow more than, the general, a generalist fund investing in other sectors in the United States or in developed markets. But certainly they want their money back and they want a good return. So that's the perspective that I bring. I think it's from our perspective in the U.S. Right now, looking at investments into companies in these sectors, the investments that we make really have to be into companies that are providing a product or a service that are going to either increase the revenue of other companies or really decrease the costs. And it can't be, you know, hoping for some government program to come along and assist that in happening. There really has to be a lot of certainty around that, either increasing the revenues or decreasing costs within a very reasonable time frame. So probably 3 years, I would say. I think the bar here is probably higher. It's certainly higher than it was, say, 5 years ago in terms of the things that we're investing in. And that's I think, largely driven by some of what Hank and Ethan described, but that there has been, an increased level of doubt about these sectors and whether these sectors can actually produce financial returns that these investors are looking for. In 2005 to 2008, there was a lot of money put into these sectors, and I think, unfortunately, there's been a lot of money lost. There have certainly been success stories, and I think like any the history of any investments in different sectors in the U.S., I think investors are increasingly knowledgeable and pinpointing what types of business models and what types of industries are worthwhile and going to produce financial returns in the future. But for these investors who, a lot of these people have to go to their boards every quarter and try to explain why they haven't gotten money back from funds that were invested in 2005. It's hard. It's been hard for, I think, all of us in these sectors to actually make our case that these are very good areas for investing in. So, unfortunately, that's sort of the backdrop of the current investment climate that we're investing into. one example is, I think, when in sort of 2006, 7, 8, you heard a lot about potentially there being a Google-type investment in these sectors. And I think the perspective has really changed on what types of investments that we're looking for. It's going to be sort of a different model of investment return that's going to succeed in these sectors that we're talking about. So at GEF, we focus mostly on the cost reduction side. I talked about the revenue increasing side of investments. I think that's certainly there, but we focused on using either alternative energies, energy efficiency, better management of natural resources in order to reduce costs to companies. So I'll just throw out two broad areas that we think are interesting right now. And so this is hopefully will serve as a data point for you all in terms of what we're seeing interesting that does not rely on government at all. And then I think you can fill in the blanks about just the huge amount of stuff that's out there that I think, unfortunately, from our perspective, is not very interesting because there isn't the proper government support. And that whole, the rest of that is hugely important, I think, for the country and for the climate. But it's just not, it's at a too high risk level for us right now. So I think one area, and Hank mentioned this actually, is that one of the biggest drivers in environmental sustainability in this country right now is large corporations. So you look at Walmart, UPS, FedEx, a lot of the automobile companies. These corporations are really driving a lot of change in the companies that supply to them, and just in consumer behavior everywhere, I think. So that's been a huge driver for us of potential investment opportunities into companies that are going to work with these big customers and really have these big corporations as their customers. So that includes increasing the efficiency of supply chains everywhere. So I think it's no secret that while Walmart has certainly gotten a lot of, I think, good press and I think, perhaps increased brand equity as part of a sustainable initiative, it also now has just a tremendous insight into its supply chain because it's demanded all of its suppliers to provide information about materials used, energy costs, exactly how that supply chain works. And, of course, that, you know, hits Walmart's bottom line very clearly. The automotive industry is pretty interesting. I think Hank Insale is really an expert in these areas, but there's a lot of interest in there in doing very simple things, very low-cost things to increase the efficiency of large fleets that supply to corporations or even for consumer vehicles in this country. So that's pretty interesting. The other big bucket of things that we're looking into right now, and this is an important area for GEF, and I think it's hard to deny the impact that this is having across the country. But it's natural gas. So while we're not investing, we don't invest directly into natural gas development and recovery. We see tremendous opportunities in the products and services around those areas. So, I mean, when you just think about the environmental footprint that fracking is having, there are really interesting companies out there that are going to be involved in the cleanup of water related to fracking and other sorts of environmental cleanup. But, essentially companies out there that are not taking technology risk, that are helping to enable the rollout of natural gas. For us at Global Environment Fund, we think that natural gas plays an important role in a bridge to actual zero carbon energy technologies. But it's undeniable, and we actually think that it's. There's some research probably Ethan has about just how important natural gas actually can be for further deployment of renewable energy power in this country, and really taking coal out of the picture as much as possible. So we find natural gas extremely interesting. I guess the thing that I'd just end with in terms of what we hope for in sort of ideal government policy is that it's technology neutral as much as possible. We have invested in the past in the solar industry and the wind industry, and I think that there is this tendency for government to pick technology winners and pick quotas, and it's not helpful for us as we're looking at this from where best to deploy our money, or even once we've made the investment, how to guide our investee companies in terms of what areas to grow into when policies are so technology specific. Natural gas, I think, is a tremendous example here of that, and how, a little bit been left out of the conversation here today. But there's a lot of focus on renewable energy policy technologies, and, perhaps if we're actually looking to reduce carbon dioxide and looking for the private sector's help in that, that policies could be more technology neutral.
Thank you. How are we doing on time today?
Elizabeth made a good point. It's one I wanted to emphasize, and it relates to the what I would call kind of the stratification of the investment sector in clean tech. Obviously, early on, for obvious reasons, the venture was everybody's focus. And as you've heard from Elizabeth and Ethan, the field has really thinned out for clean tech venture firms. Some of the big traditional firms that got into it have sort of quietly or not so quietly left the field, which is understandable, went back to areas that they were more familiar with. The capital markets have been tough for early stage because of a lot of the factors that were talked about. So now you're seeing that the private equity firms that are still in the game are very much more focused on later stage, as she said, companies that are making a profit, that really already have traction, they've had their technology adopted. And fortunately, there are examples of those, and that's good. But I think as for the committee, it's very important to think about early stage and later stage is now being really, really kind of separating. And to take a fresh look at early stage, I mean, other than people like Arch Ventures, we need to be sure we've cultivated early stage investors in collaboration with the government and the research community. So anyway, that was the one point I wanted to make.
Thank you.
Great. Ethan, you said something that was very interesting, which is you made the distinction, the difference between sort of clean tech and investing in the internet and telephony. Perhaps you can elaborate a little bit on that for the benefit of the audience.
I'll take a crack, but I think certainly Hank could, it's probably better having actually done a number of deals in this area. But, you know, I think one of the things that we've certainly seen on those venture investors is that they did, you know, wade into the sector, get very excited about it, and deploy a lot of capital. And and sort of there was a, I would say, I don't know, they came at it from the same way they came at typical venture investing for things they knew well, like software and some doctors and other things like that. And there was, I think, some people learned, unfortunately, the hard way that it's you can develop your technology to a certain point with 5 or 10 or 20 or even 20, $50 million. But when it comes to actually building a $200 or $300 or $400 million, you know, demonstration scale plant, which is where you really need to prove the technology can be done at cost, it's hard to raise that money, and it still is. And this is the, you know, this is one of the, you know, so-called valleys of death that is, I think, is clearly still out there. I think the loan guarantee program in its original form, before it got changed in 2009, but in its original form, really focused on this issue. And I think that it's still an important issue that's out there for policymakers to think about. But I mean, Hank, if you have anything to add on that.
No, I think that's good. I mean, the capital intensity, it's now often it's become a bit of conventional wisdom that clean tech is capital intensive, and not only in the smart grid, but there are other areas that we've been fortunate that we've found companies like our storage company is not a battery manufacturing company. It's basically developing the systems and the software to allow thousands of batteries to actually work together and move quickly. So it's not as capital intensive as it might otherwise be. And there are plenty of firms that you can outsource manufacturing to. So so I think that's one important point. I guess that would be the main point I would make.
Let me follow up with what both Ethan and Hank said and give the audience an exam. BrightSource, solar concentrated project in the desert. They've raised over $2 billion. They haven't done an IPO yet. Another company that's a household name that a few years ago was the largest market cap company in the country. They raised a total of $40 million before doing their IPO. What's the name of the second company? No. It was more subsequent. It's Google. Difference, capital intensity versus not degree. Elizabeth, do you see in the world that you're looking at, particularly overseas, an opportunity for leapfrogging where utilities with spokes may not be the way to go, let's say in Africa, and you can see distributed electricity rolled out. What do you see there?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, that's certainly what we're seeing in Africa. You know, people in Africa have greater access, at least, to buying telephones than they do often to reliable power sources. So it's this is a huge area of interest for us. Also, a different mix of power generation sources. So biomass, for example, in Africa, I think is going to make a lot of sense. You know, people in Africa burn biomass just now. They just, you know, burn it for heat, essentially. So it's sort of just changing the way that these resources there in that country are used. Certainly, solar is another area where you know, we see potential for that in Africa, and I think the way that the energy distribution system in a place like sub-Saharan Africa, for example, is developed is going to be very different from in the U.S. I mean, certainly, though, it's going to benefit from a lot of the technologies that have been developed here in the United States and in Europe. But you know, you never know. I think what types of things will come out of the development. That will then be useful back to the U.S. I mean, we see this also in biofuels with some of our investments in Latin America and just in natural gas as well, natural gas for transport. Just the sort of opportunities now that are here in the U.S. Based on business models that have taken place in certain Latin American countries. For example, I mean, one example is with compressed natural gas and LNG as well. Who knows what the potentials are, I guess, for the U.S. In those areas.
If I could just, a couple quick thoughts is that one, in terms of the numbers, one of the things that we've seen is a much higher level of diversification geographically in terms of where money is now flowing in the last couple of years. And certainly non-OECD countries are taking a much bigger share of the money. And even interestingly, as a sort of subtrend of that, the biggest developing world countries are accounting for a smaller share. So Brazil, for instance, was sort of the 10,000-pound gorilla in Latin America in terms of all financing for clean energy, and we're actually just doing the numbers for last year. They saw investment actually go down there, but it's gone up spectacularly well in Mexico and Peru and Chile and a few other places as well. So there's greater diversification. I think if I sort of one thing I think advantage that the developing world has enjoyed is sort of a third mover, a fourth mover advantage, so to speak, in the sense that they didn't have policies that were supportive of this stuff. Clean energy was frankly too expensive for many of them 3 or 4 years ago. But in the meantime, Germany and Italy and other countries put in place very supportive policies that have allowed the industry to scale enormously and have driven costs down to unprecedentedly low levels. And now is actually a very good moment for them to start to get into this this field. And then the last point I would make is that from the industry perspective, what we're seeing in a number of our clients is that because Italy and Germany and the traditional markets are not what they were, in the U.S. as well. Big manufacturers, developers, and others are more interested than ever in answer the question of, what does the policy regime look like in Thailand or what's going on in Turkey or Peru? They are very actively pursuing these opportunities because they desperately need them, frankly. We're in a very acute oversupply situation in the wind and solar markets right now. So you have a lot of players that just need new opportunities, and they're going after them as quickly as they can.
Just add one point, just underscore something, because I know from working with Dave Garman and colleagues over the years, distributed, moving away from what we call big iron, huge plants, lots of pipes, lots of wires, to more distributed solutions has always made a lot of sense. But the United States had so much assets in place and so much inertia, it was very hard for major moves in distributed solutions. But when you're on a greenfield, distributed solutions make an enormous amount of sense. And this is where leapfrogging is the most exciting. And one area that at SAIL, we invest in sort of incremental improvements. We're not looking for Google. Fortunately, we weren't looking for Google even at the beginning, but know that there are certain incremental improvements. One area that just requires looking across stovepipes is the energy-water connection and the fact that wastewater treatment is one of the biggest consumers of electricity, and that's totally unnecessary if you have a new, more modular kind of an approach. So there are a lot of examples like that.
Let me open it up to the audience. Question. You got your hand up.
Jay Abt, Carnegie Mellon University. This is a question for Hank, and then I've got one for Ethan if we have the time. Finn Kidlin and Ed Prescott in our shop got the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics for showing that consistent policy, monetary policy in this case, was much better than square-waving the system every 4 or 6 or 8 years. How long a time would you judge that consistent government policies would be necessary in this area? I think that's something that we could certainly weigh in on. But what's your feeling, Hank?
Well, it's a great question, and government's never going to get it perfect and needs to be able to improve ideas. But I would say that certainly longer than a presidential term. From a private equity standpoint, you look to get traction and return on investment in a 5 to 7 year time frame, ideally. So I think in those kinds of terms. So being realistic, 5 to 7 years is certainly one time frame that would be extremely helpful. It allows, and I think for capital investment cycles, you talk to people in utility industries and so forth. What are their capital replacement cycles? One thing that I tried to do at EPA was to really encourage the regulators first, you know, all the different regulators, the air, water, waste regulators who regulate an industry like the pulp and paper industry or electric utilities, to actually coordinate with each other and to understand what the capital replacement cycles of those in those firms are. Not that we would totally, you know, contort ourselves to meet that, but it's important for regulators to understand that and try to dovetail with that as much as possible, because these decisions that are made are, as you know, 20 to 40-year decisions.
I think that's very helpful. Can I ask one
question?
Yeah. So Congressman Barton made a quite forthright statement that, if I remember exactly, was almost every clean tech investment made by the Obama administration has gone bankrupt. You've got the data. What are the numbers?
I don't know the answer other than say that statement, since it's such a definitive statement, is definitely wrong. I mean, clearly they had to have at least one that worked out. But there's different ways that people quote it. I mean, the loan guarantee numbers, which I don't know off the top of my head, but the Loan Guarantee Office will tell you that they've had a very high success rate, and they have, if you look at the full portfolio. But I did make a point earlier, which is that the original intention of the Loan Guarantee Program was to support experimental technologies under the 1703 Loan Guarantee Program. Then Congress, in its infinite wisdom, as it put together the stimulus program, expanded the loan guarantees so that it could be used for conventional clean energy technologies as well. Well, the kind of good news in retrospect for the Loan Guarantee Program is that that allowed them to put in a lot of solid, very reliable General Electric wind turbine, you know, projects that are certainly going to do fine and are going to generate cash flows and are not going to fail. It's a complicated question. I mean, not to get too far into this, but a complicated answer to that question in terms of the loan guarantees, because the overall portfolio, frankly, if you look at it over the scope of it, looks really good. The question is, how does it look within just the scope of the experimental technologies? And I would still argue it probably still looks pretty good if you look at the kind of, you know, batting average that a guy like Hank or other, you know, private equity investors look for, which is that they expect to lose, you know, I don't know what it is, 8 out of 10 times or 9 out of 10 times.
No, not those guys.
Not these guys, but one or two. Venture investors, right? So my point is that, you know, the point of that program was to support experimental technologies. And the point of it was that a lot of these weren't going to work out, but a few of them were going to come along and change the world. And I think that's still a distinct possibility. We may still get there. But then just, you know, more generally in response to the overall question, look, a lot of money was spent by the stimulus program through the 30% cash grant program. And that was literally cash out the door as a replacement for the production tax credit. And that has helped to build, you know, that helped to spur what was last year the largest deployment of clean energy capacity we've ever seen in the United States, with about 17 gigawatts of new capacity. Those projects are not going to fail. They've signed long-term, you know, PPAs. They're going to repay their lenders. So it's a kind of a ludicrous statement. It's just ill-informed.
Just to follow up on what Ethan said, Ethan's right, the sort of old Silicon Valley model was make 10 investments, 8 will probably go belly up, but 2 will just be, you know, get 500% internal rate of return. You're not going to get those kinds of returns in clean tech. The investment's generally going to be too large. The gestation period is too long. So, therefore, you have to make your investments. They're going to have a much higher batting average. Otherwise, you go broke. Next question.
Thank you. Great panel. A couple of you, Elizabeth, Hank in particular, have made this distinction of early stage, later stage. I wonder if we could break that apart just a little bit in the research world. Clark Yellings from Electric Power Research Institute. We tend to use NASA's technology readiness levels from 1 to 9, 1 being exploratory, 9 being you're in commercialization, and in between there's proof of concept and so on. And some of you, I hope, are familiar with that. So if you break this up for me a little bit, what do you mean by early stage? I kind of know what you mean by later stage, but where do you draw the line?
I guess I will take a crack at this, but with the preface that, I mean, we're not early stage investors, I think, across any sort of phase of it. But, you know, one example, I think, is that we in the sort of 2004 and 5 time frame made some investments into wireless sensor technology companies with the sort of understanding, and all of our due diligence really backed up this this understanding that they were that there was low technology risk and that it was proven technology, and that the risk that we would be taking was really on the market front, building out the customer base and just really deploying it into commercial use. And so for us, I think we learned an important lesson from that, which was that a lot of the standards had not been set, and it was hard to predict what those standards were. And I think that is a really good role that the government can play in the future, is to come to terms on standards very quickly, so that there is and unfortunately, I guess really from the broader perspective, we just now don't really invest in that phase. So like I say, for us, we call it growth stage private equity. So within the private equity world, I think GEF is actually on the very early stage of things. We're not leveraging our companies. We're not doing leverage buyouts. Our investment funds themselves tend to be $100 million to maybe $300 million total. And within that, we make 8 to 10 investments. The companies that we invest into in the U.S. have revenues of $10 million or more. In a place like sub-Saharan Africa, it would be probably $5 million or more. But we're not delving into the lab or into technology risk at all. The risk we are taking, we like to think, is entirely on the market front and on the finding new customers and growing revenues front.
Yeah, and just to add to use Ethan's parlance, so angel stage, so something is in the lab. Angel stage would mean that it's ready for a prototype that's close to a scale size prototype as opposed to a bench scale. And the A round, which is a company, in our view, A round is a company that has commercial traction. It's not profitable, but it has commercial traction. It's gone beyond the prototype works, that the tires have been kicked. Customers are actually starting to use it, but it still is cash flow negative. And then you get to B, C, and D. Sometimes they go farther down the alphabet, but B, C, and D rounds usually are, when you get to B and C, you should be, the crossover points are EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, positive, and cash flow positive. And you'd like to see them cash flow positive by the second or third round. A cutoff is usually for getting to growth in later stages, $10 million in revenues. Exit, which would either be a strategic sale or an IPO, you want them to be well into the double digits of EBITDA and in the 50-100 million range of revenues. Depending on the business, it could be higher, but those kinds of markers.
Steve Barrett with the Academy. Elizabeth talked at quite some length about natural gas as an attractive area of investment, but none of you have talked really about the impact of the advent of shale gas on clean tech investments, and I wondered if you could elaborate.
Yeah, I guess I'll take the first crack at it. I mean, I think And I think that the technologies that are on the deployment phase are the ones that are most on the front lines of sort of being affected by what's going on in natural gas. Though it probably is, I would imagine it's very interesting background music for you guys, although you're thinking 5 or 7 years down the road as well. But it's certainly a challenge for wind in particular in the United States. It's been that's often what wind projects are competing against. And I don't know if this came up. I'm sorry, I missed this morning. But one of the questions, obviously, in town is, well, what if you just put a price on carbon? Well, you'll solve the problem, and you'll have all these. The reality is, if you put just a price on carbon, you're probably going to get a lot of gas and a lot of efficiency, but you may not necessarily get as much renewables as you want. Now, it depends on what your goal is. If you want to just cut CO2, hey, maybe that's the way to go. But if you're trying to build a U.S. clean energy manufacturing industry, et cetera, which I hear a lot about around here, it won't do it, at least in my view, because of the natural gas boom. So there's certainly competition there. I know there's the potential for the two to interact nicely together because natural gas has the ability to turn on and turn off, scale up and down, and sort of fill in the gaps on wind intermittency. But in the short run, it's somewhat challenging. But it should also be pointed out that the wind industry is also facing other problems, which is that the state-level renewable portfolio standards, which were the big driver of the industry's growth, in many cases are being met, actually, in a number of states. So those are not pushing demand the way they used to.
Dave, you had a question?
Thanks. Dave Garman. I ask this question now because the issue of energy in developing markets has been broached by this panel, and I think it's something to think about. Emerging markets, developing markets, that's where things are being built. That's where electricity growth is occurring. Meanwhile, we are probably facing flat electricity growth. And it begs the question, this panel is being asked to look at ways to incentivize commercialization of new technology. Are there things that the federal government should do to promote since things are being built overseas, or perhaps get out of the way of having impediments to having things be built overseas? Are there policies that we should consider in our recommendations? I mean, for instance, in the nuclear field, 801 export control policies make it really tough for a lot of U.S. companies to be involved in some of the things that are going overseas. And there may be analogous things in you know, IP issues and other things that prevent U.S. companies from being as involved in some of these projects. Do you have any recommendations for us in you know, with the recognition that the stuff's really being built overseas?
I think that's a really important question. I think it's you know, something that certainly I think should be in the back of everyone's mind is that even if we, in this country, you know, even if we do completely change our energy mix and decarbonize it, just the growth of these developing markets means that it really wouldn't make that much of a difference to the overall climate picture, right? I've seen something about, you know, I think if we instantly were to turn off, to change overall the coal plants that we're using to natural gas, still in 20 years from now, this country is probably only going to be responsible for 15% of the carbon dioxide emissions in the world. I mean, I think there are some interesting projections about that. So it's something that we see a lot with our U.S. companies wanting to expand because markets are flat here or even they're growing here, but they see tremendous growth opportunities in Africa or in Latin America. And for the communities in those developing countries, these U.S. companies have a good brand name and are very well respected. And to be able to say that you've deployed technology successfully in the U.S. goes a long way when you're maybe competing for a municipal contract in Mexico or in Peru or, you know, in Tanzania or some place like that. So, you know, I can't. I think generally, yes, any policies that would allow U.S. companies to expand more easily abroad is helpful. I think one thing that's not helpful for sure, and this is I think it's I don't have a good answer for this or a good solution for our congressmen and our senators, but certainly a lot of the discussion around growing clean energy in this country is tied up with jobs and growing a base here of jobs. And I think that's often, it's a different question than figuring out what is the best business model for deploying the cleanest energy possible in this country or in other countries. And so I think, you know, for us, some of our investors do, you know, care about, especially in the international markets, actually, a lot of our investors care a lot about job creation, and I think that can be harmful. And I think that's, obviously not harmful completely, but I think that sometimes can be complicating for us in terms of investors. You know, it's hard for us sometimes to have for example, in some of our U.S. or some of our international investment funds, we have foreign country investors along with private sector investors, and it's hard for them to sort of see eye to eye often, and sometimes there are competing pressures on us in terms of growing the best business model versus creating jobs. And so as I think about our U.S. companies and the perception that they're going to create by creating jobs abroad, I hope that that's not in conflict with also getting support from the U.S. government per se, because I think there are great businesses that could be grown here in the U.S. And part of that is going to be by also having offices in other countries, and that shouldn't be seen as a negative.
Can I just add? I really feel strongly about this, Dave. I think, you look at where demand is growing. You can throw in the towel, or you can say, what's our comparative advantage? And I strongly believe that the U.S. still has, major comparative advantages in a number of key areas. One of them is we do have the best developed private equity and venture capital. You look around the world, it just is not developed. It's not effective. It's getting stronger. But second is our ability to assimilate multiple cultures, very smart people from different cultures and backgrounds around synthesizing big ideas. And the third relates to that, which is to create kind of a nerve center to take a lot of different developments in technology and be able to weave them together with intelligence, to be truly global. We still have huge advantages in those areas. Now, the challenge is there's not a lot of manufacturing there yet, although there is some. The challenge is intellectual property, because we're developing software and systems where intellectual property protections are important. That's one thing. But beyond that, I just think it's important for all the institutions that do exist, the OPICs and Ex-Im Banks and the other, again, multifaceted programs that don't coordinate with each other in the federal government, to just look at ways of putting the wind at the back of those markets without goring any oxes, because I do think it's a big opportunity, and I think we're crazy not to see where we have an advantage and promote it.
I guess if I could just add a couple quick things, which is, well, one, we have a real trade problem in the clean energy industry now, which is that we're on the verge of a trade war. I would say there is a actual trade war underway within the clean energy industry now. China has just announced that they're going to impose tariffs on U.S.-made silicon that we export to them. The U.S. has imposed tariffs on Chinese-made equipment coming in here. The EU is in the middle of imposing tariffs on Chinese-made solar equipment coming in over there. India and the United States are in a spat. Japan and Ontario are in a spat. There's a lot of disputes going on that all have the potential to boost the final cost of clean energy for the consumer. Putting aside the issue of who's playing fair and who's not, but the end result could be we get higher priced clean energy. And on that question of fairness, one thing to be aware of is that a number of countries around the world now have so-called domestic content requirement rules. Brazil, Ontario, India, you name it, a lot of them. And some of them have sort of de facto domestic content situations where, foreign companies don't tend to win tenders in China very often. So those, finding a way to create a sort of a global free market, a tariff-free market for clean energy, I think would be a start. And the International Center for Sustainability and Trade Development, I think, has been working on this for a while. The one other thing, just sort of thinking longer term about the U.S. role, I guess I have sort of take a very sort of practical perspective on this, which is that I think in reality the U.S. is never going to be the hub of manufacturing for technology once it becomes commoditized. So, once that happens, and it's happened now for conventional, crystalline silicon photovoltaics, it gets offshore, it goes somewhere else. But the good news is that it's still an iterative process. The technologies still need to get developed. And sort of for high-value manufacturing, let's say for the making of the capital equipment that's used to make, photovoltaic modules or to make the next photovoltaic modules that are more sophisticated, there are manufacturing jobs that can be had on U.S. soil. But I think it's important to be practical, that once something really scales and it becomes commoditized, it's very hard to keep manufacturing, on soil here.
I'd be curious in response to that question, David, to hear from Dr. Lester about the possibility of taking our thorium technology and letting other countries have access.
So I think Paul Sindel has one quick question, then we're going to have to wrap up and move on to the next panel.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of the above. It's really, there are a number of these different kind of schemes, whether it's loan guarantees, buy-down programs, subsidies, venture fund, you know, acceleration funds, all can theoretically work. I think the key is that they are, they're not kind of focused, the winners and losers. I know it's a cliche, but it's very important that it's open to the best technologies on the merits, that there are rewards and penalties for success and failure, and that the company and the investors have to have skin in the game, whether it's through matching funds or things like that. It can't be seen as free money, and there has to be alignment as much as possible between the government program and the investors so that the consequences are felt either way.
Hank mentioned alignment, very important. The other thing that I think is important, that the entity, the government entity, whether it's a green bank or whatever it is, has to be staffed by people that have got a lot of experience in making investments and know what they're doing. Right. They can't be government officials, because right. If you're government officials, you haven't had the experience. And smart as you may be, that's not going to work.
Okay. Very good. Thank you all very much. I think...